on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Two for the price of one today. Two brothers from Wasco, California, who both served in World War II and who are pretty inseparable all these years later. We'll hear more from younger brother David Crawford before we're done. But for now, big brother Emery explains his first taste of combat with the 63rd Infantry Division, 255th Regiment, in February of 1945.
There was a railroad track, and the company was on a defensive position behind the railroad track, and that's where I went to. And the snow was on the ground, and it began to melt, and dead horses were being exposed and dead bodies. I come down with a case of diarrhea for 3 days. I couldn't do a thing. So it's a good thing we were on a defensive position because I couldn't have done anything.
And you were a replacement troop. And just that name in itself is kind of intimidating. That means the guy who was there got killed or hurt, so they needed you. But did that hit you at the time that this is going to be pretty dangerous?
Well, you know, really, I didn't think about that, but I knew I was a replacement, but I didn't think about being killed. We sat there on the defensive position for quite a while, and then they said we were going to take the woods. And when we started across, when the infantry, the riflemen, were out front and started across the woods, the meadow, and the Germans were in the trees on the other side, they opened up with machine gun fire, cross machine gun fire. They dropped in mortar rounds and 88s. They pinned down all of those riflemen out in the middle of that meadow all day long, and it was night before they could get out. And during that time, there was a good portion of our company was either killed or injured. And I heard that it was 80% of the company was lost that way.
And where were you while that was going on?
Well, I was in a mortar squad in a weapons platoon, and I hadn't got out in the meadow, so I was back in the woods on the other side. And so I wasn't exposed to all that gunfire and mortar fire.
Were you guys firing your mortars, or were you in a spot where you just had to sit there and watch?
We just had to sit there and watch.
That had to be awful.
Now, there was a little tank attached to us, and he went out into the clearing, was firing into the woods. 88s dropped right in on them. They must have had the place zeroed down because they just wiped that tank out in no time at all. And right then, I was glad I wasn't in the tank division, because when you get hit by a cannon, you don't have a chance. I guess later on, the next day, and so they reorganized, and we got into the woods, and that's when we had almost hand-to-hand fighting with the Germans, but I was in the weapons tune behind, so I wasn't a rifleman right out there in the front. Those were the heroes that had to face all that, so I felt glad that I wasn't right out there in the front. Maybe that's a bad feeling.
Well, the bad feeling is when you know some of those guys who are getting killed, and when you realize that, as you said, 80% casualty rate, that's catastrophic. How did you deal with that at the time, with this awareness that guys are dropping all around you?
Well, I wasn't aware how many were being killed, but I was concerned, yeah. But being just a 19-year-old boy, you don't think about death too much then, but when something like that happens, you begin to think about it.
And in that mortar platoon, what did your duties consist of?
Well, first I was an ammo bearer to carry the rockets, and then later on I become the gunner, and I had to carry that 30-pound mortar on my shoulder. They took my rifle away from me and gave me a .45 pistol, and that .45 pistol didn't feel very safe. Then when Patton started his big push into Germany, we began to follow up behind him, and they took the mortar away from me and gave me a bazooka. So I was walking and walking and walking, following up behind Patton's push, cleaning out, checking, make sure there wasn't any straggler German people. I got come down with strep throat for 3 days. I couldn't hardly talk, but we were to run all left everything, so there wasn't any place for me to go. So I just kept walking and got over it. But we would walk from, say, 5 in the morning until about 10 at night, or maybe later, dig a slit trench, one person lay down and the other guard, and then every 2 hours you'd shift. And when I wake up in the morning, if I laying in there, I'd have frost all over my shoes. We had shoe packs, and they give us an extra liner to go in the shoe. We carried one underneath our jacket pinned to it to dry it out, and then change every day. And when we got caught up with Patton there at the Siegfried line, they put us up in the mountains there, and I guess all of the German defense was down in the valley there. And when we went into the Siegfried line, there was no resistance. There was no German defense there. And the next morning, here come the armor up through where we were and went in. After that, that's about all of the war I was involved in. And I was put on guard at, say, this warehouse where I got my, where I found my helmet and my Luger, and I kept it as a souvenir. I was put on guard at a underground factory that went back into the mountains for about 20 miles with a railroad track through it and little tunnels off to the side where they built airplane engines. Then our unit was, they done away with it. And I was transferred to a headquarters company. They said they wanted 3 volunteers, you, you, and you. And I was one of those 3. And I was put into the PX in downtown Frankfurt, Germany. Frankfurt, Germany was practically rubble then. There wasn't hardly any buildings standing. And I was stayed there the rest of the time I was in the occupation of Germany, which was a really nice place to be. They gave me an apartment downtown. I went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and got off at 5. We had German workers working the PX, and we just had to supervise. That was a good time over there for me. I had an opportunity to go on the Swiss Rome tour. That was a very good experience, too.
A few questions I have here. So you got over there and went into combat. It's still the winter, early 1945, right after the Battle of the Bulge. That's why they needed so many people, or part of the reason. You talked about the mortar, and you talked about the bazooka. Most people haven't operated either of those weapons. Can you give us a taste when it's time to fire, when the battle's going on? What that's like on that mortar squad, how frequently you're firing, or what that experience is like?
Well, while we were on the defensive position there behind the railroad track, we set up the mortars and we would fire over into the enemy's position a lot of times at night. And one time, boy, there was a big explosion and fire over there from one of our rockets. But when you're on the move, you don't have much use for a mortar. But on the defensive position there, we used it a lot. You just fire over our people into their position. You don't know what damage you might be doing, whether you killed anybody or anything like that. So, as far as I know, I didn't kill anybody while I was over there. Now, I could have went from the mortar.
Just reading your facial expression there, maybe that's a good thing, that you don't know whether the shells you fired killed anybody or not.
Yeah, I would hate to know whether I'd killed anybody to speak of, because I don't believe in killing.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind, if you're firing your mortar, that's one direction. But isn't there stuff coming back the other direction? And how close did it come to you?
I never experienced any 88s or anything coming into where I was. Most of it was out there on that meadow that I remember. You know, after the Battle of the Bulge, that was pretty much the end of the war as far as what Germany was going to be able to do. They were on the run back home. That conflict we had with Germany there, I don't know why we had so much resistance there with them, because right after that, there wasn't any. We just started walking.
I know the weather conditions were tough to deal with. I mean, you're sleeping out in the open if you have time to sleep. You're walking constantly. You're worried about your feet freezing. I'm sure the food wasn't all that fantastic. What was the toughest part of it to deal with? Was there an aspect of your service that was the most scary, the most agonizing, the most nerve-rattling?
Well, I think that time with the conflict with the Germans at that on that meadow in the trees would be the one that would stick most in my mind as one of the worst times. But that walking, you run off and left your kitchen, you're living off the land as you walk, and it was cold. You would stop and rest for a few minutes, and you're ready to get up and go again because it got so cold. We would go into some of these small villages and go into their chicken house and get some eggs, go into the cellar and get some bread and jelly so that we could have something to eat. But some of those German residents would be down in the cellar huddled up, scared of us. That wasn't a very good experience, too.
You mentioned the underground factory. Do you know where that was?
No, I couldn't really tell you where it was. It's in Germany, but that's about all I can say. It was in a mountain.
Well, and the only reason I ask is because there were so many of those where they hollowed out mountains. They had these underground factories so that they couldn't be bombed under there because, you know, the enemy couldn't see where they were. But a lot of times the work in the factory was done by slave labor, people that they had captured and imprisoned and were treating horribly. And there were some concentration camps where the Jewish prisoners were sent to perform that slave labor. Were you aware of, at all of what was going on in the concentration camps? Had you heard anything about that?
No, I hadn't heard anything till later on about that. I didn't get to that area at all.
Was that kind of hard to believe when you did find out about it?
Oh, yeah, it was hard to believe, to think of trying to destroy a race of people. It's just unbelievable. But on that underground factory, there was a tunnel that went back into the mountain, and then there were little tunnels going off the side, and they were lathes in there, and they had to be people that was good at working with lathes to make these airplane engine parts. So I don't know if they'd have any slave labor in there.
Well, I did a little research, and that factory was in Wiesensteig. You can actually drive through that very same tunnel today. It was actually just a highway tunnel, the Lammerbuckel Tunnel, completed in 1942, but the Nazis enclosed both ends of that 2,000-foot-long tunnel, and as Emery indicated, it had other tunnels connecting to the main one. I've got a link to the history of that tunnel at hometownheroesradio.com. and a picture of one of the armored doors barring the entrance when the 63rd Infantry Division arrived in Wiesensteig. But back to Emery's memories. What did it mean to you when you heard that Germany had surrendered?
It was a great feeling. And after the war, I was guarding some prisoners. They gave me a rifle, but they wouldn't give me any bullets to go with it. I don't know if they was afraid the Germans would take them away from them or afraid we'd kill them.
What were your interactions like with those German prisoners?
They weren't trying to do anything. They knew the war was over, and so we weren't worried about them. I didn't have any animosity against them, but I know some of the... we had one soldier that his brother had been killed, and he had it against him, boy. But as far as I was concerned, I didn't have any ill feelings to them, because I figured they were soldiers doing the job what they're supposed to do.
You mentioned your helmet and your Luger, some pretty unique souvenirs that you brought home with you. How did you stumble across those?
While I was guarding a storage shed, I walking around in the shed, and on the shelf, I seen this helmet and an oily rag in it. And so I went over and picked it up and took the oily rag and unwrapped it. And there was the Luger in it, so somebody had oiled it, stored it, and hoped to come back to get it, I guess. But I took it.
So you've got a German pistol and a German helmet, and you've had them for 70 years. When you look at that helmet now, what do you think about?
Well, I wonder about the person who wore it. It had a break in the helmet. I don't know whether it's a shrapnel or something that broke it. And I was just wondering about the person who... it belonged to. I don't know if I want to return it to him, to the family. I want to keep it.
Is there party? I know I don't want to exaggerate, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are there times where you look at something like that and you say, boy, I'm glad our side won. I wonder what things would have been like if we didn't.
Oh, yeah. If Germany and Japan had won the war, I don't know what our country would be like. Because we have the best form of the government that I think the world has ever known. We have people that represent us. We don't have a ruler that has all the power to govern us. But we are people by the people and for the people. And we decide who will lead us. And we have the freedom to worship and do what we want to do. And if they had won the war, I don't know what we had been like.
You articulated those principles very well, and it makes me wonder if, at the time, if that's what you felt you were fighting for, those principles and ideals of America.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, we were fighting for the freedom to live and live a life free from domination by anybody. But, you know, I guess I'd call it sin in the world. There are people like to dominate one another. We can't seem to get along with just like nowadays is fighting one another over there in Asia. And it's hard for me to visualize people that want to control everything like that.
Well, and we all hope that being aware of history can have some impact on the future. We shall see. In our immediate future, we'll hear more from Emery and also his brother David, two of the Wasco Union High School graduates who will be part of a centennial celebration for that school in October. A few years ago, some students there researched the young men from Wasco who had died in World War II. The population of the city then was just a shade over 4,000, but 32 of Wasco's finest paid the ultimate price. I have a link to some of that information at hometownheroesradio.com. But just for example, some of them died in the Battle of the Bulge, in the horrendous Typhoon Cobra in the Pacific, in combat, in training, so many different stories. But think about that number, 32 from a little town of 4,000 people. We're thankful to have two of Wasco's surviving World War II veterans with us on the program today, and we're back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now playing. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord! Raise them up!
Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com.